Hello and a warm welcome to the Stark Talk podcast series of 2021. To hear new episodes as soon as they're released, do subscribe to and download the podcast on BBC Sounds or your own chosen podcast platform. And I really hope you'll enjoy listening.
BBC Sounds.
Hello and welcome to Stark Talk here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Edie Stark and I've come to the Edinburgh flat of one of the country's most outstanding artists. He was born in Paisley, moved south as a teenager and found fame in London in his 20s after attending Chelsea School of Art during its uber-trendy creative peak in the 70s. He's had more than 40 solo exhibitions and his work is held in more than 40 museums and galleries, including Tate Gallery, the V&A, the Scottish National Gallery of Modern Art and Imperial War Museum, as well as being in corporate and private collections. His work isn't easy to categorise. He's long been drawn to the crumbling built environment, decaying urban East London buildings and neglected landscapes, more recently remote Scottish islands and large mooned views from Calton Hill. His work is fearlessly executed and edgy and beautiful, but what is certain throughout is that his unique maverick attitude is compulsively devoted to a love of the very act of painting, in fact, paint itself.
Oh, thank you very much, Edie Stark Promotions. Paint itself, yes, that's my subject. I like a musical analogy. So if you have the orchestra, you've got the wind section and the brass section, the voice or the string section and so on. You've also got the bloke at the back with a triangle who just goes ting. So I like the whole gamut of marks in painting. I like the drift and the bleed, impasto and number one sable. You probably know I failed my 11 plus and sort of stuck with it now after getting on for half a century.
John McFadgen, I'd like to start with a seminal day in the late 50s, which you've written about in the preface to a monograph by Rowan Moore. When you were a child, your grandfather took you to Fairfield, one of the greatest shipyards in Govan, and then afterwards to Kelvin Grove Art Gallery. What do you remember most about that day?
The height. We had to walk up a ladder which just went right up to the sky. I remember it was a nice day. We went to the top of the crane and there was a sort of wooden hut at the top where the driver seemed to live and they brewed tea and stuff and I was introduced to this other bloke. And the view, of course, was fantastic. Yes, afterwards we went to the art gallery and my grandfather wheeled me up before the great St. John of the Cross by Salvador Dali. And he also explained blasphemy to me, explained surrealism, and he explained that we were looking down in the head of Christ. And he also showed me the Impressionist pictures and explained how if you stand up close to them, it's an unrecognisable sea of brush marks, but when you stand back, they come into focus. And I've remembered that day for a long time. And that was my mother's father. And I was very fond of him, and he was the sort of slightly roguish member of my family who were already very suburban and stuff. Whereas my granddad used to come round on Saturday lunchtime with oysters, ice cream oysters with coconut and that, and he'd come in a truck, a pickup truck with Wimpy written on the side, an orange truck, which of course my mother was black-affronted, as they used to say in those days, because my parents were aspirational working class.
Did you have any idea, though, when you were in Kelvin Grove Gallery at the age of, what, 9 or 10, about what your future might hold? You're now an academician of the prestigious Royal Academy, your 70th birthday celebrated there and at the Dovecot Studio, City Arts Centre and Scottish Gallery in Edinburgh. In Manchester, a major retrospective at the Lowry Gallery. You've got three places that you can call home, Edinburgh, London and in France. As a boy, did you have your own aspirations? Did you have ambition?
I wasn't ambitious at all, which is why, to reiterate, I failed my 11 plus, left school at 15, didn't listen to the teachers, was a disappointment to my father, who was clever and sort of had dragged himself up by going to night school. And in those days, they used to say he had bettered himself. And so maybe because he'd done all that, I didn't feel I had to. But I was sort of dreamy and bored and hated school.
He taught you to draw, though, your dad, didn't he?
My father was a beautiful draftsman, and so was his father, who died before I was born. But anyway, someone of their social class wouldn't have dreamed of being an artist, because that was what posh people did.
But did your dad eventually think that you were a success, despite being this 11-plus failure?
No, not at all. My father thought that the art business was for gays and weirdos, and of course he's absolutely on target there, he's absolutely right. He disdained all of that.
So never really said, you've done very well, Jock?
When I started making money and stuff, he respected that, because, you know, people do in this world of ours. And he used to ask me from time to time, how do you get money? Because, you know, in other words, he could have said, do you mean people buy this rubbish? I could see it in his eyes. That was the real question. He did say to me, oh, I can't say it on radio, but he said, all you can do is draw naked women, which I thought was quite a reasonable ambition. and I would say to him, oh, you make us endless car tyres, which...
He worked for Michelin.
He worked for a tyre factory.
You were encouraged, though, in your art by a teacher called Miss Sloan.
Yes, Miss Sloan was a tiny wee sparrow of a woman who, when she strapped you, she had the toughest, the hardest, the most painful strap in the whole of Renfrew High School. And she made the hardest and baddest boys cry. But she took a shine to me and made me take a letter home to my mother saying, I advise that your boy should attend Saturday morning classes at Glasgow Art School.
The alternative would have been going to boxing classes, apparently.
Yes, because I had been bullied at school, funnily enough. You know, suburban Glasgow, being bullied. There were a lot of very tough street gangs in Glasgow. You know, Tongs, Ya Bass, and Fleet, Ya Bass, and that kind of thing was scrawled everywhere. So there was a hierarchy of villainy. And if your parents had saved up enough money to buy their own wimpy home, you were regarded as some sort of toff.
So you went to Glasgow School of Art. You realised that you were perhaps quite good at something by this stage?
Well, I thought I might be artistic, yeah. But the thing I saw at Glasgow School of Art, which I'll never forget, was somebody had taken a coffee table and put it on the wall as a painting. And I mean, the surface of the coffee table with stains and fag burns and rings of, you know, and they just placed it on the wall. And I got the same frisson of awe that I did from St. John of the Cross by Salvador Dali.
You'd also won several art prizes at school, though.
Well, I won the art prize, you know, sometimes. And
So even now, does that seem less than getting the maths prize?
Oh, God, yes. Doing something that's easy is, you know, is no prize at all.
You moved to Stoke-on-Trent in the mid-60s. You were 15. Your dad had got that job in the Michelin factory. Did you cling on to your Scottish identity, or were you pretty willing to adapt to this new homeland?
Yeah, I did adapt. I didn't want to go to England. And I had an agreement with my parents that if I didn't like it, I could come back and live with my grandparents in Renfrew. But I actually loved England because there was no aggression. There were girls at the youth club. There was Tamla Motown. There was the Beatles. It did exist in Glasgow too, of course, but it was sort of frowned upon. There was not a teenage culture that I felt surrounded by, and there was in England.
So how did you then respond to this teenage culture that was in England? Were you a mod? Were you a rocker? Were you a hippie? It was too early for punk.
It was too early for hippies as well.
How did you dress?
Well, I mean, even before I came to England, I was dressing. I had long hair and I had Cuban-heeled Chelsea boots with a pointy toe, and my jeans were so tight that I had to undo the stitches before I could get them off, kind of thing. And so that was my dress code. And so it fitted in quite well, because I used to buy, you know, fabulous 208 and things like that and look at pictures of pop stars. When I came to England, there were lots of people like me.
You went to do an art school foundation course in Newcastle under Lyme. You couldn't go straight to art school, presumably, because you didn't have the qualifications. Would that be right?
That's exactly right. If I'd stayed in Scotland, I couldn't have gone to art school because you needed your hires. And, of course, as we've established, I was a dunce. So where we had ended up, the big potteries, the Daltons and the Wedgwoods in Stoke, were still functioning. And every one of the five towns seemed to have a little art school, basically to train people to paint ceramics.
In preparation.
There were mostly women, actually, whose husbands might go down the pits or go in the pot banks. And the women were painting, and they were called paintresses. And when I was a foundation course student, we were taken round the potteries. The conveyor belts would come past with the plates spinning, and one woman would flick on the leaves. A little bit like Frans Hals, you know, that facility of accuracy and expressiveness. And the plates rotated as they painted them. So there was a real need for training people for the industry.
So were you able to go to do the foundation art course instead of being at school? Because you were very young.
I was 16. There was a school in our street, actually. And in Scotland, we didn't have to wear a school uniform because I went to Renfrew High School, which was sort of secondary modern. That's why I could dress like a third-rate bass player in a band as a school pupil. But in England, you had to wear a school uniform, even though it wasn't a posh school. So obviously, I went for the Cuban-heeled shoes and the pointy toes and went to art school.
You were very keen on motorbikes then, and indeed still are.
Yeah.
When you were 17, you had a pretty nasty collision when you were on your motorbike with an articulated lorry. It put you in hospital for several months, so obviously this wasn't just a straight break.
Yeah, I was in hospital for 5 or 6 weeks, and then I was on crutches for months. So it was quite nasty. I had a Matchless G2, which is about the worst motorbike you could get, but it was smashed to bits, which was probably where it was headed anyway. And I hit this articulated lorry side on, which hadn't noticed me bombing along the dual carriageway. And so I managed to aim for the cab, because obviously I realised in that split second that if you hit an articulated lorry side on, it's probably decapitation.
And yet you've continued with this fascination with bikes. You collect them still, even into your 70s. I think you've got something like 13 motorbikes. Do you see them as being collectible design items?
Oh, yeah.
There's... Is there an art there, in other words?
Oh, I don't think motorbikes are art. I think they're design. But yes, I'm just thinking, as you asked there, Edie, I mean, I suppose if I ducked down, I could have maybe gone underneath the trailer. If I was only James Bond, I could have done that. But I wasn't going to risk it. But yes, motorbikes are quite beautiful things because they're very ergonomic. I mean, there are some horrible-looking motorbikes and, you know, that look like cars. And I think cars are the ugliest things on the planet. I mean, they're just junk, really. They look as if they're designed by Walt Disney to me. But motorbikes are more like a piece of sporting equipment. So the relationship with the human body is palpable throughout the design. You know, you place yourself on it and you adjust it to fit your body as well. You know, you raise the bars up or you move the foot pedals and all that kind of stuff. So it's like a piece of clothing.
So when you get on that bike at the age of 71,
mm-hmm.
do you feel like the 17-year-old again?
If you have a serious crash, you do tend to ride a bit differently afterwards. Because before the crash, you feel invincible if you're a teenager. I'm more careful now.
When you were recuperating, though, you had to take time off the art course that you were doing. And when you went back, you found that they were no longer doing the life drawing classes which you had enjoyed, that the things had moved on. And in some sort of rebellious reaction, or perhaps it could be seen as petulance, you burned an effigy of the school principal, which kind of didn't do you very many favours, did it?
No, I mean...
You got expelled eventually, in fact.
I got expelled, and I had to finish the course at another art school. And of course, can you imagine being a 16-year-old boy seeing a naked woman posing? I didn't even know what life room was. They just said, you've got to go to the life room after lunch. And of course, I feel, you know, do you imagine, you know, Dougal and Father Ted? I kind of looked, I looked at this woman and went to my little donkey that you sat on, you know, with your wooden drawing board and bulldog clips. and acted, tried to act natural, whereas it was the most exciting day of my life to date. After my motorbike accident, two things happened, because before my motorbike accident, it was mods and rockers. You know, the mods liked Tamla Motown and they drove Lambrettas and Vespas. And I'd gone with the rockers. I, you know, had a Norton or whatever, and I went around and listened to rock and roll. And during my time in hospital, it was the summer of love. You know, my pals were wearing bells and kind of flowers, you know, daisy chains and stuff, and their hair was even longer. And I kind of thought, what's all this? So that was then, it was sort of dope and acid and Captain Beefheart or whatever, you know. The 60s was flourishing, let's say.
And it suited you?
It certainly did suit me. I mean, to paraphrase Harold Rosenberg's quote, "The herd of independent minds," I certainly joined in with passion.
Your girlfriend, Carol, who became your wife, got pregnant at that time. Your son, Jamie, is now in his late 40s. You got married to Carol in 1972. She was 18, you were 21. You were both so young. How did you earn money?
Oh, crap jobs. I was a hospital porter. I worked in a wine and spirit warehouse, stacking stuff. I was a dustbin man. And I had the indignity of emptying the dustbins at the very art school that had chucked me out. But my wife, my young wife, my child bride, Carol, whatever ambition we had came from her. And her best friend Barbara had gone down to London to live in a squat and chalk farm. And she, Carol was missing her, and she said, "Let's go down to London and you could go to art school." Pretty difficult to get into art school if you've been chucked out of your foundation course. So what had happened was that I'd started painting. I never really stopped. And I'd started exhibiting a little bit locally in the local theatre in Victoria Street in Stoke. I went back to see the principal, Mr. Holt, who had been the pottery teacher, and he'd become the principal. And I said, "Look, I'm a reformed character. I presented myself as a..." And he had actually seen one of my exhibitions and had been pleased that I was still going, and probably surprised. And so he tore it. He actually tore up the report in front of me. I remember it was written on blue paper, and he tore it up. "So thank you, Mr. Holt. If you're still alive, you will be about 130 now, I suppose. But anyway, it actually got me onto the next stage."
So you and Carol went off to London. Bring us up to date just for a moment, though. Tell me about Susie Honeyman, who you've been with for 30 years or thereabout. You married within 6 weeks of meeting each other, so you must have made quite an impression on each other at the time. Tell me about that.
Well, I saw her at a party, Susie, and she was playing with another musician. She's a musician. She plays a fiddle in a band called the Mekons and electric violin. And she's classically trained, and she, you know, ran away from the circus basically to join a punk band called the Mekons in 1981 or something. And so I saw her and, you know, fancied her and all that, and looked at her and assumed that she was, her boyfriend must be this accordion player. Anyway, I made inquiries about her, and, you know, we got together. We had love at first sight kind of thing. It was on my part anyway. I don't think she noticed me, so she didn't see me because I was probably hiding behind a door watching her.
But 6 weeks to decide to get married.
Yes.
When you'd had a marriage that hadn't worked beforehand, you just knew that she was right for you, and obviously she is.
I didn't know that at all. I mean, this was a retinal appreciation. I liked the shape. And I liked the movements, and I liked the fact that she was making a noise as well.
What did you think she made of you then?
Oh, I'm sure she's got a pretty reasonably accurate opinion of me. So, you know, she's probably a cross between a social worker and a nurse.
Going back again then to those lean years when you were with Carol and you went down to London and you lived in various squats, some much posher than others, mind you.
Well, if you go to squat, you don't go and squat in Peckham. You choose a good address. I mean, we were squatting in Christchurch Street, so Christine Keeler was living along, not squatting. She actually could afford to live in Chelsea. And round the corner was Flood Street, and Margaret Thatcher lived there. She was leader of the opposition. So there were a lot of rich people around, and there were empty houses. So I had a couple of very posh houses that were quite near the art school, because Chelsea's not an affordable area. You used to see Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and the Mamas and Papas. You used to see Ken Russell and his Jag, John Betjeman putting out his Milk. I mean, it was sad my marriage didn't survive going to art school. That was a sad time. But if you're going to have a sad time and live in a squat, then you go with the flow, and there were lots of parties. It was fun as well.
And you were at arguably the top art school in the country.
The thing about Chelsea, it would be embarrassing to make work, because everybody sees what you do when you go to art school. It's not like uni, when you actually, they don't see your thesis, you know, because you're in your room writing it. Everybody sees your work all the time because you're making it. So you're looking over your shoulder, and that makes the bar go up, I think. It's competitive. You don't want to be a sort of boring old fart. You've got to be cool. You've got to be on the money. You've got to be the edge. Otherwise, you're going to look stupid and nobody will dance with you, kind of thing. So there was definitely an element of that and a feeling of that, and that was a vibe. We had lectures from Tom Stoppard, Quentin Crisp, Klaus Oldenburg, Ernst Gombrich, and it was a bit glamorous.
And you loved it?
Yeah, I was starstruck by the very art school that I went to every day, really, and I certainly didn't want to look like a schmuck. So I tried, you know, I really, really worked hard. And my work became about art. And if you were painting, you really had to justify it, because people were down on painting, intellectually down on it. Why paint?
You sold your first painting in 1974 in Covent Garden when it was still a market. Your first show was in 1978, a year after art school. And then you got a dealer. So success came pretty quickly.
Yeah, I had a good run. I thought, well, this will just carry on. It'll get better and better forever.
Well, your work, which you were doing while you were at art school, was what you call schematic. It was almost cartoonish. It was very knowing and witty and cleverly referencing other art. And as we've said, it was very popular. People liked it. It got noticed. And then in 1981, you were appointed artist in residence at the National Gallery.
Yeah.
Where you decided that you were a bit fed up with this jokey, clever stuff, mm-hmm. and that you were going to paint what you saw around you.
It wasn't such a change. My pictures were still figurative. And when I did the gallery thing, I was labouring under the weight of and the authority of 2,000 old master paintings. And those preoccupations, art that was in dialogue with its own history, did seem rather slight in comparison with the unfolding story of art since the Renaissance. So I actually did realise I was going to run out of juice. I also had a singular lack of success. I did have a dealer, Blonde Fine Art, and they sold quite a lot of my work, and I had enough money to, you know, I'd bought a flat, I had a nice car, I could get drunk every night if I wanted, and all that stuff. But when I did the residency at the National Gallery, my dealer had an exhibition of my paintings, and I sold absolutely nothing. I sold one drawing, actually, to my most loyal collector, and nothing else. And so suddenly I had no money, and I thought, that's it, my career's over at the age of 31. I have nothing to lose. And it's a great position to be in as an artist, because if you are a painter and you have, let's call it a style, it's an entrapping situation. A bit like a record company with a band. You know, they want the same thing.
So it suited you then to have gone slightly out of fashion?
No, it didn't feel like that at the time, mate, but it did, yes. Suddenly I couldn't afford to put petrol in my car or pay the mortgage. And I thought, well, I went out with a sketch pad and looked at what was around me, and things looked a bit bleak. You don't have to go far when gentrification turns into inner city desolation. They're all cheek by jowl.
And also your studio was in the East End, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You've been called the laureate of stagnant canals, filling stations and night football pitches, a tourist without a guidebook. And I noticed that you're using that quotation for the title of your exhibition in the Royal Academy this year. The people then disappeared, though. You took out the lonely, forgotten, real people that you saw around you. But that coincided with being commissioned to create the set for Sir Kenneth Macmillan's last ballet, The Judas Tree. You'd become popular again, otherwise you wouldn't have been asked to do such an incredible commission.
I started making pictures which were of things I'd seen, and the things I'd seen or been drawn to depicting were fairly factual. I like realism, and I like... I like faction if it's done right. You know, I like In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, and I like Hilary Mantel very much, taking the facts as a, you know, a join up the dots thing, and then the fictive part is melded in, like piano keys. And I like that very much in painting as well. And I became interested in topographical painting, like L.S. Lowry, for example. I like Lowry. One of the things I like about Lowry is that he's not liked by curators because he can't be put in an iconographical drawer. He can't be placed in the unfolding story of art. He's an oddball. There's a north-south divide. He's perceived as being working class, even though his mother was a piano teacher, and so on.
So you relate to that in some ways.
I like the idea that Lowry engenders hostility, provokes hostility in the establishment. And I like, yes, the outsiderishness. It dawned on me that I was painting places rather than people. It started with the people, and the people over a period of years got smaller and smaller and smaller, and they'd been getting smaller by the time Kenneth Macmillan popped into Cork Street and inquired after my phone number. And the set had 2-3 cars on the stage and scaffolding and all the rest of it. And the corps de ballet and the beautiful Viviana Durante and Irek Makhmedov, the Russian principal. The figures were supplied. I didn't have to make the figures. I did the costumes. So after that, I suppose I felt emboldened to make a series of pictures where there were no figures at all.
The exhibition at Dovecot and the Scottish Gallery, which you've done recently, featured mostly work made in Scotland on Calton Hill or Arthur Seat in Edinburgh, Carnoustie, where your mother lives, Uist, Harris, Malig. You've told me in the past that you go cruising for something to pick up. So is it something that just catches your eye? I mean, how do you know this is what I want to paint?
Yes, we're revisiting another conversation we had some years ago, Edie, when you called me out for describing my subjects as simply a coat hanger for the paint. And that made me think a lot, and I dwelt on it. And it's a little bit like when you have an argument with somebody and you go your separate ways and you take some of the other person's position with you, I think. And I thought, maybe she's right. God, maybe she's right, maybe it's not, maybe I am sort of... And I do agree with you, I think there's an unconscious... It's a little bit like a divining rod, and you're looking for water and the twig starts shaking, you know, and you don't know where the water is, but you know it's there somewhere. So maybe you're drawn to the subject without knowing the reasons you're drawn to it. I mean, you were going on about my collection of motorbikes at the beginning of our discussion, and I realised later in life that maybe it's the legacy from having been brought up in families of engineers who worked in the Glasgow shipyards. Maybe it's not genetic, but maybe there's this kind of a compulsion to handle bits of metal and have a workshop and have a vice and have some spanners and do stuff. I think that's definitely part of my, you know, part of my family's legacy on me, even though I'm a terrible mechanic and I still can't do long division and work out how things are meant to fit together. But going back to the painting, I think that the East End of London does remind me of the desolate rusting shipyards in Glasgow, the dissolution of the dockyards and the estuary, you know, the Clyde. There's something familiar about it all to me. And I think there's something there. So that's a concession. in fact, that is a concession. And for me, there is opportunism. I mean, you can be driving along and suddenly you pull over and take photographs of something. You think, bloody hell, I can make a good picture out of that. But of course, you don't say, why would I want to? Or why does that appeal? It could simply be that, you know, you can knock it into something that we're formally arresting and exciting visually.
I think what you were saying at that time was that there was no agenda or any narrative to your paintings, and I found that very difficult to believe when the subject matter was something that you went back to again and again, and surely there has to be some sort of social comment about what you choose to paint.
This is good. I hope we're going to start arguing. I mean, I suppose as a journalist...
There's not enough time for us to argue.
One wants to actually have a story, and maybe the public is the same. They want to look at pictures and say, what does this mean? And the idea that it means nothing is slightly disappointing.
We were talking there, though, about you being drawn more and more, it seems to me, to the Scottish landscape, to remote islands, and indeed the landscapes of Edinburgh, which is where you have this flat. Does the very act of painting these places make you feel part of the landscape and therefore identify more as a Scot, albeit one whose main home is in Bethnal Green in London and your studio's in London Fields, which is also in the East End? But do you feel that when you are painting Mallig, it is touching something that's at the core of you?
Well, good question. And a multi-layered question too, because when you get older and you're from a place like Scotland, you actually do think, God, how long have I got? I've never been to Galloway. Or, you know, I hadn't been to Edinburgh when I was Scottish up until the age of 15. In fact, I didn't come visit Edinburgh until I was 27. And I couldn't believe Edinburgh was in Scotland. It seemed unlike anywhere else in Scotland to me. However, the first challenge or the first glove that was thrown down for me was when I was invited to make an exhibition at the Peer Arts Centre in Orkney, certainly more than 20 years ago. And when I got there, where's the urban despair? Where's the sort of desolation? Where's the, and I was tempted to go and find something that some bad boys had burnt out a car or, you know, daubed something on a bus shelter. And of course, you don't get any of that in Stromness. I'd have had to go to Kirkwall and even then really hunt around. And so I went the other way and I thought, well, don't be ridiculous. You know, you don't revert to type. Paint that sheep, paint that bit of sea. And that was such a help to actually not be given something that was familiar.
But going back to my question, have you found more about yourself as a Scot through painting that landscape, through painting those remote places?
No. I've had not, Edie Stark. I have found out more about myself as a painter.
Even though you've got that ridiculous name, Jock McFadgen.
I'll confess, it's a made-up name.
Well, finally, because we're now completely running out of time, going back to that time when you were a boy and your grandfather took you to visit the Dalí in Kelvin Grove and he helped you to see it and you stared up at it in wonder, how would you like your work to be seen by generations to come?
I'd like them to be shocked, actually. All painters want to make paintings that can't be walked past.
But shocked into what?
Well, that's going back to the story, isn't it? Shocked into understanding something. I don't know. Visually arrested. Visually shocked. And then maybe they say, what is that? What's that about? But of course, the Dalí is a realist painting. It's a painting that's full of message, that's full of narrative, that's full of high realism. So what do I want them to think? I'm a tourist without a guidebook. I don't even want to know where I'm going. I think we'll have to do another interview in a few years, because last time you interviewed me, you gave me something to think about for some time. What do I want them to think? I certainly don't sit down to make a picture thinking that I want anybody to think any bloody thing at all, actually.
But do you think about the person that might be looking at your art in the Lowry Gallery or in the National Gallery of Scotland?
I think about what people will think of my work after I'm dead. Yeah, I certainly do. I think all painters are painting for the time after they're no longer on the planet. Definitely. Because it doesn't really matter if nobody cares about your work at the time you're alive, because you're only doing it for yourself anyway. So you're painting for people of the future. I certainly feel that. I think painting's a thing which is not confined to its time of construction.
John McFadden, thank you very much indeed. It has, as it was before, been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Edie. I'd love to do it again sometime.
BBC Sounds.
Next time, my guest is the amazing textile artist and curator and best-selling writer, Claire Hunter. Protest, of course, is in the fabric of the book, and it's very much part of you. How did political protest and needlework come together for you all those years ago?
I was already working community arts, and then I went to Mansfield in Nottinghamshire in 1984 as part of that year's May Day parade, because the trade unions wanted the community more involved. But of course it was the year of the miners' strike. And when I went to Greenham Common, which I did shortly afterwards, then again you had thousands of women, 7,000 women, 8,000 women, basically blanketing the fence, which meant they were hanging up textiles about why they needed and why we should all want and campaign for peace and the end of nuclear war. But what they were using, which I thought was extraordinary, they were using fabrics from home. So they were using sheets, pillowcases, tea towels, in order to really emphasise the fact that they were women who cared, who were mothers or wives, and what they cared about were their homes, their communities and their families. And so by that simple use of the kind of cloth they were using, it was a really, really interesting way of not just about sewing, but how textiles themselves could be used to express something deeper. And I became more and more fascinated by that.
You can hear this programme as soon as it's unveiled and selections from the archive by subscribing to and downloading the Stark Talk podcast on BBC Sounds or your choice of platform. From Edie Stark, many thanks for listening.